excuse. Yeah, so yeah, so we're talking about Socrates, and we're going to look at two dialogues or two documents that Plato wrote regarding the end of the life of Socrates. I'm not going to talk about the Phaedon, which is when Socrates is in jail, because it was bigger than I thought. And maybe my next class should be on that, and we're going to compare different things. But for now, I'll stick to the Apology, which is Socrates' trial. Just as a question, has anybody here read at least one or two dialogues of Socrates before, of Plato, before coming here?
Plato is a student of Socrates, right?
Yeah, he's the guy that wrote the dialogues.
Of Socrates.
Yeah, Socrates being the main character most of the time.
Being his teacher, right?
Yeah. Est-ce que tu as déjà lu des dialogues de Platon?
J'ai lu un peu sur le procès.
Ouais, l'apologie, c'est ça.
Moi, j'ai lu sur Seneca. You know about Seneca? Seneca? The
Is that a Roman?
I think he's a Roman. He's one
Yeah.
of the first before he came before Socrates. He's the one who implemented
Came before? Okay, that's possible. But I'm not going to talk about Seneca. Tomerlane, est-ce que tu as déjà lu? Non? Ok.
Oui, mais je me souviens.
Non, à l'école.
Oui, mais
Okay, so it's important because I think these two documents are important because they help students like ours to understand Socrates from a more personal standpoint and the importance of what he was saying, versus having an academic approach of dividing everything that's being said into arguments and counter-arguments, which is very, which can actually prevent you from really understanding what Plato meant or Socrates meant. But first, let's have a short video of what a sophist is. Right, you guys heard that, and we'll see, right? There's a fight, and when you read Plato's dialogue, you see there's a fight between sophists, who are considered as the most knowledgeable people at the time, people that know how to speak, knows rhetoric, and Socrates actually exposing those people, fighting against them. So I'm going to show you a little clip. It's in French, and it's a very good idea of what a sophist is. And it's a little excerpt from a movie. the title of the movie is called Ridicule, so ridiculous. And it's during the it's at the French court. And at a friend, and it's there's a guy who basically is trying to save his develop. He's trying to develop his area, but he has to go see the king. But the problem is that he has to become acquainted with everybody in the so-called salon, where everybody talks. They try to talk in a witting manner, trying to be smart, but they're just saying a bunch of crap. And what we'll see is actually a guy talking to the king. And remember that the king is the representative of God, right? So if you mess up religion, it's not good for you. So I'm just gonna show you this.
The film in French.
I gave her the link.
Oh, okay.
She has all the stuff she needs. Yeah. Just a short, like 2 minutes in French. Yeah. I downloaded it already.
Oh, you did?
I can't. I don't want to talk about the video. You have to see it. It's very good. I'll try open it again. Because it's a daily motion. Maybe while we're waiting, So in this book here, which is a it's a translation, it's a translation but a rewriting of Socrates' Phaedon dialogue by Moses Mendelssohn. And there's a little part about the life of Socrates. And it's also very important, again, because Plato is misunderstood. Plato is most of the time being seen as a very... it's like a guy on welfare keeps talking, you know. And, you know, talks to people and have these very interesting discussions. Although we're dealing with a war hero who was decorated, participated in three different wars, was a sculptor. That's how he was. His father was a sculptor, so he became a sculptor. But he quickly came engaged through some of his teachers in, you could say, the idea of rhetoric, but really his own very specific approach. And
so are you speaking of Socrates?
Yeah, Socrates. Yeah. So, the word?
You have to kill the process.
Okay.
So he fought in three wars?
Yeah, and he was actually a very, very strong soldier. And there's something that you see. In certain individuals, also like Aeschylus, was the playwright who put on his tombstone, you know, like as an epitaph, saying, didn't say, read my plays, they're good, or I'm a playwright. He says, I fought the war at Marathon. So you have these people that are dedicated not just to a certain system, like their state, right? But also dedicated to a certain idea of a growing republic. And because Socrates evolves in a dying republic, let's call it that way, like a dying nation. So he's in a dying nation, so he's from a different a different background. What he believes in is very different from everything else that's happening in his okay. Yeah. So we'll start yet. I'll tell you when it starts. It's a funny movie. Okay, now it's gonna start.
Les Égyptiens qui traversent ces monstres au fond de leur temple, voyaient qu'il n'y a qu'un effet dont on puisse demander quelle est sa cause. Or, l'univers ne se présentait à ces païens que sous l'aspect d'une cause très puissante.
Je ne dirais pas encore que notre siècle manque de grands
religieux. La première de toute chose va être nécessaire, absolue, parfaite. Non, il ne peut y avoir deux êtres infiniment parfaits, car deux ne pourraient pas plus. L'être parfait ne peut être utilisé. Celui qui est par lui-même ne peut changer. Or, le temps est la mesure du changement. L'infiniment parfait ne change pas. L'unité, immutabilité, éternité, c'est lui. C'est Dieu qu'on a souillé sa propre cause.
Bravo, Victor, Céline.
Bravo, Smerlin. J'ai démontré ce soir l'existence de Dieu. Mais vous pourrez tout aussi bien démontrer ton prêt quand tu verras à sa majesté.
Non, la Bastille, j'ai pas dit avec une autre.
Majesté, ça n'était qu'un trait d'esprit.
Échoué si près du but.
Ah, madame, le roi semble manquer d'esprit aujourd'hui.
got caught telling the truth or something?
Da-da-da-da. Can you just open the light?
Turn it on.
Okay, I don't need that anymore. Well, he proved the existence of God, so the king was very happy. Because the king, you know, he likes God. But then he said, but I could prove the complete opposite whenever the king feels it's time.
Oh, I see. I didn't
that. So the king, and then the bishop says, you're going to end in jail. You're going to end in the Bastille. You get my word for it.
he wasn't technically a Socrates. He was kind of telling the truth too, right?
No, he was just talking. Like I don't understand what he's talking about. He's just throwing a bunch of words.
Yeah, he didn't prove anything.
Okay, so it was a Socrates.
Yeah.
He kind of told a bit too much.
Yeah, but what happens if someone tells you I'm going to prove that God exists, but I can also prove the opposite?
Okay.
Right. Does God exist? Yeah, I'll tell you. Okay, does God does not exist? Yeah, let me tell you. Same guy. So, that's a sophist. And you can actually see, it's interesting because...
it is like in the political campaign?
This is French courts. Everybody is completely immoral and... You're supposed to be smart, but smart like witty. And as I was saying in one of the resume of the movie, if you're witty enough, you can actually destroy someone's life, someone's career. Like it happened a couple of times in the movie. They have all these games and, you know, like a smart crack on someone, and you just destroy his life. Yeah, sure.
When you say he's a sophist because of what he said, or because he changes his mind?
Well, I think for both, because what he says is complete gibberish. Right? It's like if I just throw a bunch of slogans I heard on TV and try to patch it together and say, oh, I proved God exists. Thank you, thank you. Mm-hmm. Didn't prove shit.
It's
just talk. Yeah, it's not beau parleur. But there's also the problem that arises because if you say that you can say prove something and then you can say you can prove the opposite, what does that tell you about truth?
But for example, if Batman said that God existed, and if he didn't say that phrase, that I can also prove that he doesn't exist, will he still be a sophist?
Mm-hmm.
Because
well, look, it's just.
He's not saying something. He's saying something for real, and he's saying.
But
yeah,
if he didn't say that phrase, will he still be a sophist?
Well, sophist, as we'll see, I'm not going to answer now because we should get in a class. I didn't know people had so much comment on the video. I thought it was just cool. But no, we'll look at what a sophist is. Look, we're. I mean. If you're in politics like we are, and you go out and try to express an idea to people, different types of people, you know, you go in the street, you have students, you have workers, people who are laid off, you have teachers, you have politicians, you have a bunch of things. And as you saw in the video, like you saw the reaction of the population, where the guy would just bumbling and like talking nonsense. The king applauded, so everybody was happy. But then after he made his mistake, then everybody, okay, well, like they completely dissociated themselves from the guy, right? And even her, friend, the lady in red, you know, he said, are you gonna help me? You know, sorry, dude. I've known you for years, but sorry. You're going to jail. I'm not going to jail with you. And she says at the end, she says, smart people in court know how to stick to their seat, to stay at their place. And as we'll see, well, look, we have this guy named Socrates, who's actually being put on trial for, it seems, for a couple of things that, you know, don't necessarily seem so dangerous. First, you got to know there are two groups of people attacking Socrates, or I guess not suing him, but bringing him to court. There are people that used to attack him for a long time for what he was doing, and people that recently decided to attack him for political reasons. Ah, okay. But first, let's. Yeah, I wanted to first give two quotes. One from Schiller and one from The Republic. Let's check that first. Just to put ourselves in the mood. Quotes Plato at the beginning. Okay, now that's Plato. Okay, I'll just open the other. Start with Schiller. That's Plato. That's Apology. It's a speech that Schiller gave on why we should learn universal history. And he first started discussing about two types of individuals. The philosophical mind and the bread-fed scholar.
Let's write it down. Bread-fed scholar versus philosophical mind. So let's just read. Comment tu t'appelles? J'ai pas demandé.
Gino.
La première page, colonne de droite en bas. Ça, ça commence. Ben, le tout dernier paragraphe. C'est là où on va commencer. OK. Okay, on va commencer le paragraphe juste avant. Ça, il parle de. Est-ce que tu peux me lire le début du paragraphe?
Mais avant que je
puisse. Ok. C'est ça. Juste écrire.
Can people read? To make it bigger.
Yeah, that's okay.
Bon.
Who's reading?
Gino? Non, Gino, lui, c'est en français, mais tu peux lire, hein? Okay. Ça commence par But Gentlemen.
Okay, so you read?
Ouais.
Okay. But Gentlemen, before I can undertake to determine more exactly your expectation of this object of your diligence and to explain its connection with the real purpose of your diverse studies, it were not superfluous for me to first reach agreement with you on that purpose on your studies. A preliminary clarification of this question, which seems appropriate and worthwhile enough to me, and at the beginning of our future academic relationship, will enable me directly to draw your attention to the most dignified side of your history.
Continue, je dis qu'en arrêter.
Okay. The course of studies which the scholar who feeds on the bread alone sets himself is very different from that of the philosophical mind. The former, who, for all his diligence, is interested merely in fulfilling the conditions under which he can perform a vocation and enjoy its advantages, who activates the powers of his mind only thereby to improve his material conditions and to satisfy a narrow-minded thirst for fame. Such a person has no concern upon entering his academic career more important than distinguishing most pleasure? Oh, okay.
Sorry, I made a mistake.
No, not yet.
No, you have to go up into the left.
Fourth line.
Oh. Whoa, shit. Sorry. Oh, okay, so I just gotta go down most carefully.
Most carefully, those scientists which he calls studies are read from all the rest which delight the mind for their own sake. Such a scholar believes that all the time he devoted to these latter, he would have to divert from his future vocation, and this thievery he could never forgive himself. He will direct all his diligence to the demands made upon him by the future master of his fate, and he will believe he has achieved everything once he has made himself capable of not fearing his authority. Once he has run his course and attained the goal of his desires, he dismisses the sciences which guide him, for why should he bother with them any longer? His greatest concern now is to display these accumulated treasures of his memory, and to take care that their value not depreciate. Every extension of his dread science upsets him, because it portends only more work, or it makes the past useless. Every important innovation frightens him, because it shatters the old school form which he has laboriously adopted. It places him in danger of losing the entire effort of his preceding life. Who rants more against reformers than the gaggle of bed-fed scholars? Who more holds up the progress of useful revolutions and the kingdom of knowledge than these very men? Every light radiated by a happy genius, in whichever science it be, makes their poverty apparent. Their foils are bitterness, insidiousness, and desperation, for in the school system they defend, they do battle at the same time for their entire existence. On that score, there is no more irreconcilable enemy, no more jealous official, no more eager to denounce heresy than the bread-fed scholar. The less his knowledge rewards him of its own account, the more he devours the claim thrown at him from the outside. He has but one stand for the work of the craftsman, as well as for the work of his mind, effort. Thus, one hears no one complain more about ingratitude than the red-haired scholar. He seeks rewards not in the treasure of his mind. His recompense he expects from the recognition of others, from positions of honor, from personal security. If he miscarries in this, who is more unhappy than the bread-fed scholar?
Yeah.
He has lived, worried, and worked in vain. He has sought in vain for truth. If for him this truth not transfer itself into gold, published praise, then Christ be favored.
Maybe that should do. So what kind of individual would be afraid that of the truth, because the truth could destroy what he took so long to build? Well, the first question is what is it that you build which, if the truth comes out, collapse? Maybe it's not that important. Maybe did people recognize some of their teachers maybe? In there,
mm-hmm.
You know, doing all this effort, but attacking newcomers with heresy or stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
to make sure that, you know, everything you've been saying for 20 years, make sure that nothing new comes up, otherwise, you know, you'll be seen as not the authority anymore. Okay, I thought that was an important point, because as we'll see later, we see that actually Socrates is very, very involved in that type of debate on whether we're going to do like what we just saw, the bread-fed scholar, or we're going to have another approach. But in I wanted to also show the quote from the Republic from Book 6, because in the book, on in the book 5 of the Republic, there are 10 books, and in the 5th book, it is where, I'm just skipping a lot, obviously, but that's where he has his famous quote about the philosopher kings, that if you want a city to be led or to be developing, you absolutely need the philosopher kings. People looking for wisdom, looking for truth, people that hate lies. And I'll come back to that. What are the reactions to such quote, which is very misunderstood today, but which was very understood by the people at the time, what it meant. And in book... Yeah.
Is the philosopher king the contrary of the sophist?
Obviously, yeah.
Wait, so we compare philosopher king to a sophist king, right?
The philosopher king looks for truth. The sophist just like to talk.
Yeah,
well, yeah, in a sense, what we just saw.
Yeah.
Let's not. Well, okay, let's.
Well,
I don't want. I don't want some academician to tell me, "Here's what a sophist means." But what we have identified is, we've identified two things so far. Like the first is the poet, just, you know, ranting just to please people, please the king. But then, whatever he says, as long as it's pleasing, I guess, you know. I'll prove you this, I'll prove you that, who cares? As long as people are happy. But then you have this other approach, this other type of academics that seems to not just talk for nothing, but does not like truth. He fears it. Says, if this guy comes up with this truth, I'm done. If it's just a game, if you're just like having this chatting game like this guy had, the poet, you can... You don't even care if the truth comes out. You don't give a rat's about anything. But it doesn't threaten you, really. Maybe a little bit. But the Bradford scholar, he has to protect himself from the truth. Right? And what Socrates does, and what we're going to see, because they're talking about how to cultivate a philosophical, philosopher king. But we're going to see also, we're going to aim more at how the philosopher king becomes corrupt. I don't need that. Donc ça, Gino, ça c'est la page, le livre où j'ai mis un X dans la page de droite. Tu vois le X à la mine? Puis, je pense que si tu tournes une page, j'ai mis un autre X pour dénoter la fin. Is this long? No, it's not too long. Alright, so as I was saying, we're going to see what can kill let's call it the philosophical mind, but let's make it bigger. Okay, people are a bit bigger, huh? Maybe it's 170. You still there, Avnit?
Did we lose him?
I don't know. Well, it's...
Oh.
While we're seeing it. Oh, okay.
I'm here.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
It's okay. Looks like Jean-Philippe.
She wasn't there all along, was she?
Huh?
She wasn't there all along, was she?
Yeah, she was.
Yeah, she was.
I'll just leave it at 150 so we can read. Oh, no. Okay, yeah, sorry. Just...
make
the font
bigger.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that better?
No, it's
That's a bit too big.
What I've noticed works well is when you just make the font bigger and then you don't have to...
There you go.
Oh.
Like this.
Oh, yeah, okay, let's see what you mean. Yeah, sure. Let's say it's 14.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need two people. I can do the... someone should do Socrates, and I'll do the other one. And it's very simple. Every time there's a paragraph, it's a new person. So Socrates, new other person, Socrates, other person, etc.
I would like to do Socrates.
Yeah, go ahead.
So it starts... And may we not say, Adimantus, that the most gifted minds, when they are ill-educated, become preeminently bad? Do not great crimes and the spirit of pure evil spring out of a fullness of nature, room, by education, rather than from any inferiority, whereas weak natures are scarcely capable of any very great good or very great evil?
There, I think that you are right.
And our philosopher follows the same analogy. He is like a plant which, having proper nurture, must necessarily grow and mature into all virtue. But if sown and planted in an alien soil, becomes the most noxious of all weeds, unless he be preserved by some divine power. Do you really think, as people so often say, that our youth are corrupted by sophists, or that private teachers of the art corrupt them in any degree worth speaking of? Are not the public who say these things the greatest of all sophists? And do they not educate this perfection, young and old, men and women alike, and fashion them after their own hearts?
When is this accomplished?
When they meet together, and the world sits down at an assembly, or in a court of law, or a theater, or a camp, or in any other popular resort, and there is a great uproar, and they praise some things which are being said or done, and blame other things, equally exaggerating both, shouting and clapping their hands, and the echo of the rock and the place in which they are assembled redoubles the sound of the praise or blame. At such a time, will not a young man's heart, as they say, leap within him? Will any private training enable him to stand firm against the overwhelming flood of popular opinion? Or will he be carried away by the stream? Will he not have the notions of good and evil which the public in general have? He will do as they do, and as they are, such will he be?
Yes, Socrates, necessity will compel him.
And yet, I said, there is a still greater necessity which has not been mentioned.
What is that?
The gentle force of attainder, or confiscation, or death, which, as you are aware, these new sophists and educators who are the public apply when their words are powerless.
Indeed they do, and in a right good earnest.
Now, what opinion of any other sophist or of any private person can be expected to overcome in such an unequal contest?
None.
No, indeed, I said. Even to make the attempt is a great piece of folly. There neither is, nor has been, nor is ever likely to be, any different type of character which has had no other training in virtue but that which is supplied by public opinion. I speak, my friend, of human virtue only. What is more than human, as the proverb says, is not included. For I would not have you ignorant that in the present evil state of government, whatever is saved and comes to good is saved by the power of God, as we may truly say.
I quite assent.
Then let me crave your assent also to a further observation.
What are you going to say?
Why, that all those mercenary individuals whom the many call sophists, and whom they deem to be their adversaries, do, in fact, teach nothing but the opinion of the many, that is to say, the opinions of their assemblies, and this is their wisdom. I might compare them to a man who should study the tempers and desires of a mighty strong beast who is fed by him. He would learn how to approach and handle him. Also, at what times and from what causes he is dangerous or the reverse, and what is the meaning of his several cries, and by what sounds, when another utters them, he is soothed or infuriated. And you may suppose further that when, by continually attending upon him, he has become perfect in all of this, he calls his knowledge wisdom, and makes of it a system or art, which he proceeds to teach. Although he has no real notion of what he means by the principles of passions of which he is speaking, but calls this honorable and that dishonorable, or good or evil, or just or unjust, all in accordance with the tastes and tempers of the great brute. Good he pronounces to be that in which the beast delights, and evil to be that which he dislikes. And he can give no other account of them except that the just and noble are the necessary, having never himself seen, and having no power of explaining to others the nature of either, or the difference between them, which is immense. By heaven, would not such an one be a rare educator?
Indeed he would.
And in what way does he who thinks that wisdom is the discernment of the tempers and tastes of the motley multitude, whether in painting or music or finally in politics, differ from him whom I have been describing? For when a man consorts with many and exhibits to them his poem or other work of art or the service which he has done the state, making them his judges, when he is not obliged, the so-called necessity of Diomede will oblige him to produce whatever they praise. And yet the reasons are utterly ludicrous, which they give in confirmation of their own notions about the honorable and good. Did you ever hear any of them which were not?
No, nor am I likely to hear.
You recognize the truth of what I have been saying? Then let me ask you to consider further whether the world will ever be induced to believe in the existence of absolute beauty, rather than of the many beautiful, or of the absolute in each kind, rather than of the many in each kind.
Certainly not. Okay. Was that sort of clear?
Let me reread the last thing Socrates says, because they didn't read it well. This point did not come. You recognize the truth of what I have been saying? Then let me ask you to consider further whether the world will ever be induced to believe in the existence of absolute beauty rather than of the many beautiful, or of the absolute in each kind, rather than of the many in each kind.
Induce. Is that a key word in it?
I don't think so.
What, I don't quite understand the end.
That paragraph?
Yeah.
Says about the
Well, maybe because we lack a bit of a, but he was talking about a
an absolute truth, an absolute.
Well, this idea is that if you have like whatever you think is beautiful or whatever he thinks is beautiful, we all have our ideas of what are beautiful things. I like that type of thing, or you know, or is there an idea of a greater idea of beauty? Is there a beauty that is universal? Is there a beauty that can be recognized by everybody? Or the same thing about the just or the good right, or evil. Because if you remember at the beginning, right, he says, well, he's picturing this person in a public room telling the truth, but having as a response something which is like a big wave of whether people cheering or screaming at him to shut up or something like that, right? And then he says, well, won't this youth be extremely affected by that? Won't he be scared? I say, yeah, just, you know. Because we're not talking about a group of 20 or 30. You're talking about thousands of people that would get into place and, you know, have this kind of contest of speaking, but implementing legislations as well. And then he's talking about the person looking for truth starting to change and addressing not the truth anymore, but trying to titillate this big beast called popular opinion. That, you know, what does that beast like? I'll call that truth, you know. So whatever this beast like, I'll tell it. So what's good becomes what this beast like, and what's evil becomes what this beast does not like. Instead of having the first person that comes out and say, well, no. I think there's a problem with our society. Here's what I think. Boo. Right? So the mind that was actually outward and looking for, maybe looking, as he says, for something which is absolute, is actually being brought down. And the idea of philosophy, or the idea of truth, becomes whatever people like.
What exactly kills the philosophical mind? Is it the sophists being corrupting those minds? Or?
Well, yeah, Socrates does attack them there. Because he says that those people, they're just repeating what the public wants to hear. They're pleasing the beast. Whatever the beast like at that moment. Right? So, if you're not looking for truth but you're trying to please people, that's not the same thing, you know? Right? If you have someone who's sick, you can please him saying, don't worry, you won't need to taste that shitty syrup we made. But if it's a lie you're telling them, because they need the syrup to be cured, you gotta tell them, look, buddy, you need the syrup. Tastes like shit, but you gotta take it. Not pleased, but you'll be pleased later, but not on the right on the spot. And that's what we're dealing with someone like Socrates. That, like you said, it says it's very rare to have people that can fight against that, but Socrates seems to manage. And in his little part based on the life of Socrates, he gives a very good example, which I think shows the importance. I mean, it's a good example, I'll just give it, but at a certain time, I think it was the second or third war, where the fleet of Athens won a major victory against, never mind the name for now. No, it's not Sparta. It's another city.
Okay.
So the Athenian fleet has a huge victory. But the problem is that the fleet itself is being destroyed by a tempest. And there's a tradition in Greek mythology that if you die and you're not being buried, your soul is going to wander forever. So you got to bring those corpses back, but everything was destroyed. So the people, and there was a coup actually to have the general sentenced to death, because they weren't able to bring the corpse back. And everybody, you have all these speeches saying, yeah, and the whole crowd is primed up. And it happened that at that time, it was one of the rare, probably the only time that Socrates was directly involved in decision making. And I'm not going to go into the details, but I think it was one of the region of Athens that was deciding. There was like a rotation among different neighborhoods of who would be in charge of the state for a limited amount of time. So everybody wanted to kill the generals except Socrates. And we just said, you guys are crazy. We're at war. You want to kill generals? You really want to do that? And obviously he stood his ground. It didn't work. They killed the generals. And obviously they got their ass kicked the second fight because they killed their own generals. So they were ready to kill their generals in the middle of a war for the sake of mythology or beliefs. And Socrates was hated for that, right? And one of the accusers, Anytus, was also a general. I mean, I'll talk a bit about that. Yeah, the same guy as Nemino.
Yeah.
But he survived, Anytus? Or was he also killed?
Huh?
Was Anytus
no.
killed?
No, because Anytus is there to judge Socrates at the trial.
Yeah.
So
who were killed? Just the generals who were involved in that particular tempest?
Yeah, they were like, I guess they were said to be the culprits. You guys didn't give the order to bring these guys back. So what do you want us to do? It's like, you know, boats destroyed all over the place. You want us to go swim and get the corpse back? It was just impossible. It was obviously, I mean, it had to be a political coup because then you just destroy, or you really, you're not just slowing down, you're destroying the ability of Athens to defend itself in the middle of a war. But Socrates stood up, and if you ever tried that, I know by experience it's not obvious. If you want to stand up to a bunch of people screaming and shouting, you need a lot of cojones, as they say. Okay, so apology quotes. All right, so let's get into that trial. So by the way, this class does not replace the reading of those dialogues, as you probably would have guessed. You're not going to have homeworks, but they're going to give you a mark. But for your own sake, I suggest you read them.
Yeah, what part were we just reading?
What we read is in Book 6 of the Republic. And just there, it refutes the whole idea of they have this idea that the philosopher king is some guy that just manipulates people, right, to keep the truth to themselves and they, but
wields the noble lie.
It's all refuted in that part. Okay, let me just get this clear here. Okay, so as I was saying, you have two people attacking Socrates. Two groups. There is the first group who says, we actually been attacking Socrates for what he's been doing for all those years. The argument they say is that they say that he makes the worse arguments the better. Okay, I didn't know it was a crime, but it seems that Socrates always managed to reverse what the person is thinking. Because that's his job, that's what he does all the time. He just confronts everybody and refutes people. So that's one of the thing. And Miletus, you see here Miletus? This guy is a younger person who goes a bit further, attacking Socrates of corrupting the youth and not believing in the gods and making up new gods. And we'll see a bit of an exchange between Miletus and Socrates. Okay. Yeah, why don't we just read that and then talk about it a bit.
Donc ce sont les deux chefs d'accusation qu'ils ont fait. C'est la corruption de la jeunesse. Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire?
Yeah, well, here's the first one. Just read it. You want to read what I underlined?
Excusez-moi, je voulais me limiter.
Ah, you want to read? Just what I...
Socrates is an evildoer and a curious person who searches into things under the earth and in heaven and who makes the worse appear the better cause. And he teaches the aforesaid doctrines to others. Sorry, that's a bit hard to read there.
All right.
Which group is saying that of Sophists? That's not the Sophists.
Well, yeah, it's important to realize that the Sophist itself is not just like a bunch of guys that just happen to talk well but not say anything significant.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and that's why also LaRouche, when he talks about Athens, he compares Athens to the United States, that you have a republic, you have a nation, or call it city nation or city state, Athens, dedicated to the development of science, development of the economy, if you want, development of knowledge. And the Athenians, for a while, they were very hard to, it was hard to kick their ass. They were smart. They were smart militarily. And it helped because it's like a shitload of wars at that time. And the Persian Empire developed that idea of the, it was like a spread of sophistry, that sophism would replace truth seeking. So, and even it's being said there that at a certain point Socrates came back to one of the first war, and he saw that it was a huge change, that he had to do something about that, that sophistry was taking over, so he had to intervene. So, well, you have three guys attacking, three people attacking Socrates. One is Meletus, who's a poet, Anytus, who's a general and is also a politician, and Lycon, who's he's considered just an orator. These are the three people. But that's one of the cause. You have 500 judges, which is a lot. So maybe it created, there was a mass, you know, like when people when you go see a football game, you have 10,000 people that very stupid. I mean, they're not thinking, they're just watching a game and eating cheap food. So sometimes when people move as a group, sometimes they tend to be less smart for some reason I don't quite know, but that even Socrates mentions certain places. Alright, so look, it's also important to realize that one thing that Socrates explains, says, okay, I'm going to explain to you why people don't like me. But what I'm doing is based on what the gods told me. And there's a, I don't think I have it here. I don't have it there. Is that there's something called the Oracle of Delphi. Just write it down.
And the oracle is something weird. Basically a cult. The oracle is this person. Okay, imagine that you're a very superstitious person. I'll just stick to the mic. Imagine you're a very superstitious person, and there is this lady who appears to be able to connect with God somehow. And she starts, you know, shaking and everything. You ask her a question and she says, let me ask you. Big guy up there, and she goes, she shakes, blah, 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 starts drooling, whatever. And then she started mumbling something. You can't hear it, but there's a guy beside, priest, who know, you know, he knows God, so he knows this language. He says, okay. And then he tells the person who wants to know what that person should, or what's the answer from the God. Sounds a bit stupid. I mean, today it might be more refined with things like astrology. It's known that a lot of our leaders do ask astrological advice. It's not a very smart thing. But the idea of an oracle is not just some marginal thing. That it's actually a way of controlling the politics of the region. So we have a general go see the oracle saying, what should I do? Should I fight? And then the people will say, well, yeah, go fight. That's what the god says, go fight. And obviously they get their ass kicked. And this oracle, working for the Persian Empire, gains terrain. So it's really a tool for manipulation.
But something special happens is that the oracle actually was asked at a certain point about Socrates, and the answer of the oracle was that Socrates was the wisest man. So Socrates, a bit confused, so why me? I keep saying that I don't know things. I'm not the wise man. And then the gods say I'm the wisest.
What god?
Well, the Olympians, like Zeus. Or I guess wherever you ask to, like Hermes or Uranus, you know, there's a bunch. So, but in there, Mendelssohn says that it might have been an attempt to seduce Socrates into, you know, shutting up and siding with the sophist. But Socrates decided, that's what he explained his tribunal. He says, okay, well, look, the only thing I did was to actually try to understand what that God was telling me. And we're going to read what he's actually doing. So he's actually going to go talk to people and see, you know, what these people think. You know, like you talk to people that are... like you talk to a horseman, you talk to a sailman, you talk to politicians. So let's just read this thing here. First thing that, yeah. So, Avnit, we're going to read the second paragraph in the apology quotes. A bit bigger, huh? So yeah, so he's already talking about going to meet people to see how he could figure out who's wise and who's not, and why he would be wise. So can someone read that part?
After this, I went to one man after another, being not unconscious of the enmity which I provoked, and I lamented and feared thus, but necessity was laid upon me. The word of God, I thought, ought to be considered first, and I said to myself, go I must to all who appear to know, and find out the meaning of the oracle. And I swear to you, Athenians, by the dog I swear, for I must tell you the truth. The result of my mission was just this. I found that the men most in repute were all but the most foolish, and that some inferior men were really wiser and better. I will tell you the tale of my wanderings and of the Herculean labors, as I may call them, which I endured only to find at last the oracle irrefutable. When I left the politicians, I went to the poets, tragic, dithyrambic, and all sorts. And there I said to myself, you will be detected. Now you will find out that you are more ignorant than they are. Accordingly, I took them some of the most elaborate passages in their own writings, and asked what was the meaning of them, thinking that they would teach me something. Will you believe me? I am almost ashamed to speak of this, but still I must say that there is hardly a person present who would not have talked better about their poetry than they did themselves. That showed me in an instant that not by wisdom do poets write poetry, but by a sort of genius and inspiration. They are like diviners or soothsayers who say many fine things, but do not understand the meaning of them. And the poets appeared to me to be much in the same case. And I further observed that upon the strength of their poetry, they believed themselves to be the wisest men in other things in which they were not wise. So I departed, conceiving myself to be superior to them for the same reason that I was superior to the politicians.
So that's where the expression comes from, when someone is talking through their ass. And it's important to realize that this is what Socrates has to deal with. And it might not seem like a big deal. Like if you talk to someone, imagine you talk to a sailman who knows about sailing, but because he knows about sailing, he thinks that he knows about all these other subjects that he doesn't know about. And maybe it would be interesting to look at, to have an idea a bit, because in one of the dialogue named Gorgias, Gorgias actually explained a little bit what a sophist is, and maybe that could help situating that, because the way he says it is very clear of the problem. Let me just right there. So that's a quote from Gorgias. Oh yeah, you don't have it because it's you don't have it underneath. It's in French, but can someone just read that?
Blow it up a bit.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's part of the Gorgias dialogue. Tu lis, Merlin? Pascal? Ah, excuse. J'avais pas vu. You go.
Don't be afraid of 24, 26. Yeah, there you go. Ah.
Oh. Okay.
Georgian is old. Que dirais-tu si tu savais tout? Si tu savais quel embrasse.
He's talking about the rhetoric, the art of rhetoric.
Je vais t'en donner une preuve frappante. J'ai souvent accompagné mon frère et d'autres médecins chez quelqu'un de leurs malades qui refusait de boire une potion ou de se laisser amputer ou cautériser par le médecin. Or, tandis que celui-ci n'arrivait pas à les persuader, je l'ai fait, moi. Sans autre art que la rhétorique. Un orateur et un médecin se rendent dans la ville que tu voudras. S'il faut discuter dans l'assemblée du peuple ou dans quelques autres réunions pour décider lequel des deux va être élu comme médecin, j'affirme que le médecin le.
Excuse.
Ne comptera pour rien et que l'orateur sera préféré, s'il le veut. Quel que soit l'artisan avec lequel il sera en concurrence, l'orateur se fera choisir préférablement à tout cas. Car il n'est pas de sujet sur lequel l'homme habile à parler ne parle devant la foule d'une manière plus persuasive que n'importe quel artisan. Telle est la puissance et la nature de la rhétorique.
Did you get it a bit?
I've read it before, so I sort of understand. He's saying that.
Well, yeah. You go ahead.
Well, he's saying that he's trying to say that the power in rhetoric is that he can go with a doctor to a patient who refuses to take some medicine, and the doctor, in that sense, will be powerless to help the patient, whereas he could convince the patient that he should take the medicine. Therefore, the rhetorician is more powerful.
But that's the first part. And there's a second part. Because not only can he convince someone to take the cure better than the doctor, but if he goes to a town with the doctor and they both compete to be the doctor of the town, if he wants, the sophist would win. Imagine that, right? You go to a city, you say, hey, you need a doctor? We got two doctors, like one doctor and the sophist. And the sophist would bullshit so much that the city itself would pick the sophist, not the doctor. Is that like, you're wondering what's the use of that? What's the use of that?
Manipulation.
Well, yeah, big time. Because, later in the dialogue, Socrates demonstrates that, in a sense, Gorgias can only convince those that are very ignorant. Like the sophist will not convince the doctor of anything about health. Because the doctor knows about health, not Gorgias. But Gorgias can convince the normal guy a bit naive, you know, because he speaks eloquently and he's well dressed or something, you know.
Would that skill work in gaining other posts as well?
Well, the way he sets it, I mean, there's
like
more to the dialogue, but the way he
president?
Sets it. President? Probably. Especially these days, huh? Especially if you look at Obama. Yes, we can. Hope, change.
Do this for this, do this for that.
If you had Obama and an economist, right? And Obama would convince people that he knows more about economics than the economists, for example. Well, we know economists are usually fucked up these days, but just an example of a, or a doctor, you know, especially with the healthcare policy.
Well, just think of Obama and LaRouche. Who would the population pick?
Well, I'll end with that, but no, I would say not anymore. After what we've seen in Texas, but let me go back to that later. So you have a guy, Socrates, and who goes around trying to see if the god is right about him being the wisest, challenging those sophists, Gorgias. Gorgias was very well known and powerful sophist, and he destroyed him in a dialogue. And Socrates is doing such a powerful job that he's being put to the tribunal for that crime. This brings another point, but also completes. This is just a bit later than what we read. Yeah?
There is another thing, young men of the richer classes, who have not much to do, come about me and their own accord. They like to hear the pretenders examined, and they often imitate me, and examine others themselves, there are plenty of persons, as they soon enough discover, who think that they know something, but really know little or nothing. And then those who are examined by them, instead of being angry with themselves and angry with me, are angry with me. This is found in Socrates. They say, this villainous misleader of youth. And then if somebody's asked them, what evil does he practice or teach, they do not know, or cannot tell. But in order that they may not appear to be at a loss, they repeat the ready-made charges, which are used against all philosophers about teaching things up to the clouds and under the earth, and having no gods, and making the worse appear the better cause. For they do not like to confess that their pretense of knowledge has been detected, which is the truth. And as they are numerous and ambitious and energetic, and all in battle array and have persuasive tongues, they have filled your ears with their loud and inveterate calumnies. And this is the reason why my three accusers, Meletus and Anytus and Lycon, have set upon me. Meletus, who has a quarrel with me on behalf of the poets, Anytus on behalf of the craftsmen, Lycon on behalf of the rhetoricians. And as I said at the beginning, I cannot expect to get rid of the mass of calumny all in a moment. And this, O men of Athens, is the truth and the whole truth. I have concealed nothing, I have dissembled nothing, and yet I know that these plainies of speech makes them hate me. And what is their hatred but a proof that I'm speaking the truth? This is the occasion and reason of their slander, as you will find out either in this or in any future inquiry.
So yes, so not only is he challenging people, but he's actually recruiting people to what he's doing. And the youth get involved. Especially as I don't know if you said it there, but yeah, I think he does that. The rich youth that have time to spend around him actually do enjoy what's happening to those sophists, not just like as an entertainment, but also these youths started doing the same. Right. So the new authority that was imposed on Athens, the sophist, is being challenged not just by one guy. I mean, but Socrates is the main guy. That's why they're going at him, not putting everybody on trial, but if try to get rid of Socrates so they can get rid of that tendency. But he is recruiting and exposing those people for being liars, as he's saying there. So that's his first statement regarding his accusation. And then I just wanted to show you, that's the last little part from the apology. That's later. Whoops. We're going to see Meletus and Socrates in a dialogue. It's a very short part, but just to show you how bad these guys are, actually. Meletus being a poet. And as he showed in other dialogues, and as he said also there, poets are not, he doesn't consider poets as being very smart. Being actually possessed. They don't recite by knowledge, they just recite by being possessed by some god, gets them to cry and weep and laugh for nothing. But here we're going to look at the because Meletus is a guy doing the first, not the first, but the main attack. He's the one that started the whole thing. So, yeah. So someone can do Socrates, I can do Meletus.
He says that I am a doer of evil who corrupt the youth. But I say, O men of Athens, that Meletus is a doer of evil. And the evil is that he makes a joke of a serious matter and is too ready at bringing other men to trial from a pretended zeal and interest about matters in which he really never had the smallest interest. And the truth of this I will endeavor to prove. Come hither, Meletus, and let me ask a question of you. You think a great deal about the improvement of youth.
Yes, I do.
Tell the judges who is their improver? For you must know, as you have taken the pains to discover their corruptor, and are citing and accusing me before them. Speak, then, and tell me the judges who their improver is. Observe, Melodus, that you are silent and have nothing to say. But is not this rather disgraceful and a very considerable proof of what I have been saying? That you have no interest in the matter. Speak up, friend, and tell us who their improver is.
The laws.
But that, my good sir, is not my meaning. I want to know who the person is who, in the first place, knows the laws.
The judges, Socrates, who are present in court.
What do you mean to say, Melitus? That they are able to instruct and improve you?
Certainly they are.
What? All of them? Or some only and not others?
All of them.
By the goddess here, that is good news. There are plenty of improvers, then. Plenty of improvers, then. And what do you say of the audience? Do they improve them?
Yes, they do.
And the senators?
Yes, the senators improve them.
But perhaps the members of the citizen assembly corrupt them. Or do they, too, improve them?
They improve them.
Then every Athenian improves and elevates them. All with the exception of myself? And I alone am their corrupter? Is that what you affirm?
That is what I stoutly affirm. Okay, so that was a bit of a trick from Socrates. Because he asked, you know, you attack me from corrupting the youth, so I guess you know who are the real educators. And Meletus was probably too much of an ass-kisser, just says, well, everybody here except you. Which is pretty... okay, everybody but me improves the youth. Okay.
Except me.
So, but... I mean, it doesn't make sense. You know? It's like, you know, about teachers, like... I mean, you could get into the argument of Socrates, but then you would check. If you want to go sailing, you ask the sailman, you know, you ask the sailor. You don't ask the horseman. But Meletus gets to the conclusion that everybody except Socrates improves the youth. It doesn't make sense. And what Socrates will do is to refute two of the times Meletus' arguments. Just laughing at the poor kid, because Meletus is very young. Just contradicting Meletus, but it's a fun part. But it shows that the society in which Socrates was a society where it didn't take much for you to be burned at the stake. If it was a couple of good orators against you. They didn't need to be very smart, but they just need to be eloquent. There was another tradition at that time, which was to force people into exile. And there's a lot of examples of. It's like, you know, if you don't like your neighbor, or if you can demonstrate like one guy is very annoying, and you get a couple of people with you, you could actually kick out anybody from Athens. It was very easy. Another thing that doesn't make much sense. Okay. So, all right. So, Socrates explained what he's doing. He says, here's why I got all this hatred. I went out there and challenged people and tried to find what was the truth. And I get these other guys who are just making that thing up, trying to get rid of me. They don't like the influence I'm having on the people, and they don't like the fact that I'm exposing all these sophists. And I will just end this part like that, saying, because at the end, he says, look, you guys, you're getting rid of someone who's extremely important. He just says it outright. He says, you guys are gonna miss me. You need people like me. You need me to kick you in the ass. He calls himself the gadfly. And the gadfly goes around and picks you and keeps you awake when you want to sleep, when you should not sleep. And he basically says, you know, you guys should have just, I'm like 70 something, so there's no rush. I would have died in a couple of years anyway. But you guys will be, you guys will feel my death. And this is a time where Athens is into a lot of wars. And after Socrates' death, there's the Peloponnesian War that starts, which pretty much brings Athens to its end.
Pericles is the leader at this time?
Not quite clear.
Pericles is a little bit earlier.
A bit earlier?
Yeah.
Because he mentioned Pericles in other dialogues, but it's in the past.
Oh.
Okay. Well, so as I said, you guys should read that little thing. It's very good. But we're dealing with a political fight. We're dealing with a guy that was trying to pretty much save Athens from this idea of sophistry, which is not just some like fashion, but which is something that is actually attacking Athens to its core, attacking the way people are thinking, transforming people that should have a mind into a mindless, monstrous beast, which is this popular opinion. So the other part, which you're going to see, we can just wrap it up with that, which is the Crito. And the Crito is, yeah, because Socrates is condemned to death, right? So he'll spend 1 month in jail, and he'll be given a poison after a certain time. And Crito is a very good friend of Socrates, who also financially backed him up many times, wants to get him out of there. So we're gonna read what Crito says as a trying to convince Socrates. That's the beginning of the first page. Wanna do Crito?
I'll do
somebody. Well, why don't I do it? Right. So Crito is in the jail room with Socrates. So he says, "Fear not. There are persons who at no great cost are willing to save you and bring you out of prison. And as for the informers, you may observe that they are far from being exorbitant in their demands. Little money will satisfy them. My means, which, as I am sure, are ample, are at your service." Crito is very rich. "And if you have a scruple about spending all mine, here are strangers who will give you the use of theirs. And one of them is Simmias the Theban, has brought a sum of money for this very purpose. And Cebes and many others are willing to spend their money too. I say, therefore, do not on that account hesitate about making your escape. And do not say, as you did in a court, that you will have a difficulty in knowing what to do with yourself if you escape. For men will love you in other places to which you may go, and not in Athens only. There are friends of mine in Thessaly, if you like to go to them, who will value and protect you, and no Thessalian will give you any trouble. Nor can I think that you are justified, Socrates, in betraying your own life when you might be saved. This is playing into the hands of your enemies and destroyers. And moreover, I should say that you were betraying your children. For you might bring them up and educate them, instead of which you go away and leave them. And they will have to take their chance. And if they do not meet with the usual fate of orphans, there will be small thanks to you. No man should bring children into the world who is unwilling to persevere to the end in their nurture and education. But you are choosing the easier part, as I think, not the better and manlier, which would rather have become one who professes virtue in all his actions, like yourself." That's me adding the bold. says, and indeed, I am ashamed, not only of you, but of us who are your friends, when I reflect that this entire business of yours will be attributed to our want of courage. The trial need never have come on, or might have been brought to another issue. And the end of all, which is the crowning absurdity, will seem to have been permitted by us, through cowardice and baseness, who might have saved you, as you might have saved yourself, if we had been good for anything, for there was no difficulty in escaping. And we did not see how disgraceful, Socrates, and also miserable, all this will be to us as well as to you. Make your mind up, then, or rather have your mind already made up, for the time of deliberation is over, and there is only one thing to be done, which must be done, if at all, this very night, and which any delay will render all but impossible. I beseech you, therefore, Socrates, to be persuaded by me, and to do as I say. So yeah, maybe I should have said it, but when Socrates is being condemned to death, he doesn't make a big deal about him dying. Like he's comfortable with the idea of death. He's not afraid of death, and it's something that philosophers should also consider. That's another subject. So Crito criticized Socrates. Says you don't want to fight this thing through. You don't want to fight the system. You're going to leave your children. He has three children. You're going to leave them all alone. And you could escape. He doesn't say there, but what he means escape is that the state, the people that attacked Socrates, they said, if you want to leave the state, who cares? You can just go into exile. We'll be fine with that. So the idea of Socrates leaving Athens would be permitted as long as he shuts up. Right.
Are Crito's argument sophistic?
I think they are passionate, but no, I wouldn't say he's. I think sophistry means very a mean intention. Native intention is important. But Crito is Socrates' best friend, financial backer as well. And I like that part because, you know, when you reflect, when you organize people in the street, or when you organize around yourself, or if you think about a guy like LaRouche, who's been organizing for 40 some years, right, talking to the same people for 40 years. And new people, but people have been following us for decades. So you would think that those people or your people close to you would know more than the majority of people. And what follows is very interesting because it just gives you an idea. But first, the thing I underlined there, the thing I put in bold character, is what Crito is actually more concerned about, right? He says, this entire business of yours, which is your death, will be attributed to our want of courage. And the end of all, here, the end of all, which is the crowning absurdity, the death, will seem to have been permitted by us through cowardice and baseness. So what is Crito really concerned about? Is he concerned about what Socrates think of Crito?
His own reputation.
Yeah, he's concerned about what people are thinking. They'll blame us. I don't want to be blamed. I don't want people to attack me. And what follows is short, but it's Socrates' first answer to that. I'm sorry, I don't want to Certainly he will. Okay, yeah, that part. That's the first exchange they have. Oops. So, someone Socrates and someone Crito.
I'll do Socrates and you Crito.
Okay.
Tell me then, whether I am right in saying that some opinions and the opinions of some men, of some men only, are to be valued, and other opinions and the opinions of other men are not to be valued. I ask you whether I was right in maintaining this.
Certainly.
The good are to be regarded and not the bad?
Yes.
And the opinions of the wise are good, and the opinions of the unwise are evil?
Certainly.
And what was said about another matter? Was the disciple in gymnastics supposed to attend to the praise and blame and opinion of every man, or of one man only, his physician or trainer, whoever that was?
Of one man only.
And he ought to fear the censure and welcome the praise of that one only, and not of the many?
That is clear.
And he ought to live and train and eat and drink in the way which seems good to his single master, who has understanding, rather than according to the opinion of all other men put together?
True.
And if he disobeys and disregards the opinion and the approval of the one, and regards the opinion of the many who have no understanding, will he not suffer evil?
Certainly he will.
And what will the evil be? Whither tending, and what affecting in the disobedient person?
Clearly, affecting the body, that is, what is destroyed by the evil.
Very good. And it is not this true, Crito, of other things which we need not separately enumerate, in the matter of just and unjust, fair and foul, good and evil, which are the subjects of our present consultation? Ought we to follow the opinion of the many and to fear them, or the opinion of the one man who has understanding, and whom we ought to fear and reverence more than all the rest of the world, and whom, desiring, we shall destroy and endure that principle in us, which may be assumed to be improved by justice and deteriorated by injustice? Is there not such a principle?
Certainly there is, Socrates.
Take a parallel instance. If, acting under the advice of men who have no understanding, we destroy that which is improvable by health and deteriorated by disease, when that has been destroyed, I say, would life be worth living, and that is, the body?
Yes.
Could we live having an evil and corrupted body?
Certainly not.
And will life be worth having if that higher part of man be depraved, which is improved by justice and deteriorated by injustice? Do we suppose that principle, whatever it may be in man, which has to do with justice and injustice, to be inferior to the body?
Certainly not.
More honored, then.
Far more honored.
Then, my friend, we must not regard what the many say of us, but what he, the one man who has understanding of just and unjust, will say, and what the truth will say. And therefore, you begin in error when you suggest that we should regard the opinion of the many about just and unjust, good and evil, honorable and dishonorable. Well, someone will say, but the many can kill us.
Begin there when you see us.
But
kill us.
Is that true that many can kill you? Shit, I had an idea. Never mind. So I thought this was a I guess it's like a lesson. Because look, you have Socrates, he gets his best friend coming in, and his friend's trying to convince him, and Socrates is like, you must be thinking, gee, I had this guy with me for all these years. I mean, was he listening to what I was saying? And then he just very calmly, you know, because Crito is nervous, not Socrates, says, look, remember what we said about the one, the many? Do we listen to everybody or those who know? Yes, Socrates is the one we know. So should we care about these guys? Say, no, we shouldn't. Sorry. Sorry, Socrates. But that's I'll come back to it, but that's an important point. I don't think that's the point there, but say if he's not able to understand what Socrates is doing, you can imagine people have been following him for years. It's a bit the same thing with LaRouche as well. Is that they'll back you up whatever you want to do. You want to escape, you want to do this, you want to do that, I'll back you up. But they're going to take the place of Socrates? You're going to take the place of LaRouche just like that? No, it's something different that has to happen. And what Crito does, what Socrates does in the rest is that he says, well, look, he wants to show Crito why he's accepting death. Although he could escape, he could go live happily at the end of his life at some place. And he imagines this dialogue where he's talking with the state. What if the state were to ask me if I were to leave, you know, and saying pretty much, look, Socrates, you had a contract with us. You lived all these years in Athens. You lived by our laws, and now you want to break those laws? You want to run away like a poor little kid who's afraid? You want to run away dressed like a woman, try to hide you here and there? What will people think about that? What will people think about everything you've been saying for all those years? Because he's saying that he's leaving Athens and he would break the laws. We're not talking about just a set of arbitrary rules. Because Socrates did, when he had the government of the tyrant, which was a few months long dictatorship, Socrates does not obey those guys' laws. Because I don't think that's what they mean when they talk about the laws. But if you keep Athens as being a product of a republican development, so you're not dealing with just some social contract written here and there. Socrates did disobey those tyrants, risking his life when he was asked to put a guy to go. He was asked at a certain point to go get a criminal, so-called criminal, and to bring him to the leaders. And he disagreed. He says, you know, go to hell, I'm not doing this. Luckily for him, the government collapsed a bit after, so he wasn't killed. But And Socrates just explained through that dialogue to Crito. He says, look, you're trying to tell me that I'm a coward because I'm not gonna take care of my kids. But look, you want me to go into exile. Like, I'm not gonna see those kids. And if you're paying for my exile, why don't you just pay for my children? You're gonna pay for me, but not for them. You're filthy rich. And he goes, yeah, Socrates. So the idea, and I think it shows a bit, and it's important when we read those dialogues to realize that what we say or the way we say it has enormous importance. Like, you have Socrates involved in exposing, as I was saying, it's not just a fashion, but it's actually a disease. Disease that was taking over a growing republic. It actually brought the republic to its demise. And which leads the many to, in a sense, go crazy. And which leads to Socrates saying, well, but the many can kill us. Not just Meletus. Meletus just accused Socrates. The judges voted for Socrates' death. It was very tight. It's a tight result. It was like 500 judges, and death won by like 30 hands. So it's not much. But it's not Miletus who judged. It's actually the crowd was primed up. Has been primed up for years to act like a bunch of, sports fan. And not just that, but it's the same thing that happens in the Republic after Socrates talks about the philosopher king. The response of his interlocutor, I think it's Glaucon, he says, "Wow, Socrates, this idea of philosopher king, it's very good, but you know that after after you'll say something like that, there's going to be a bunch of people taking their sword out and trying to kill you." He says, "Yes, but that's the conclusion that we get." Right? So this idea of fighting for truth at a certain point, it's not just some option. It is there. It has to be there for the development of the society. The same way Socrates was able to recruit people through exposing a fraud. And I think the difference with today, Socrates was living, 400 BC. Socrates does not see any Italian Renaissance or German Renaissance. He didn't see no American Revolution. He didn't see no industrial development. He didn't see no railroads, right? When you go to war, bare feet and have your shitty thing to protect yourself from the cold. It's like it was depraved. He didn't see no Treaty of Westphalia. He didn't see no radioactivity, development of radiation, these sorts of things. He didn't see the man going to the moon. So we are in a position where actually, unlike Socrates, who had to avoid being a political figure for the fear of being killed, we're in a very, very different position. We're in a position that it's actually a tool. It's the tool that we got to use to change the society, to go into politics. And we have now the set of laws that Socrates was defending has now become much bigger and much more powerful as well, which is something that we got to use the same way that we've won this election in Texas. Because you got to keep in mind, right? First time we said Obama had to go, people were freaking mad, right? People who organized with us know that. You had all these people, you got to give him some time. It was like 3 months after he was elected. We already started attacking him. And the mustache came out, I think, in April or May, after he was there in March. So we went out there with the truth. Did people recognize it? No. Did people try to bash us? Well, yeah, they didn't try to kill us because there are laws, They're not going to try to give you some poison or something. But they were freaking mad. And people were throwing our tables on the floor and stuff like that. Yeah, people are sometimes they're just pissed. They're not evil, but they're super pissed. They try to physically challenge you. Nothing to worry about. But the population is extremely upset. It's like this big monster Socrates was talking about, right? And it can be very scary. Say, oh my God, maybe we shouldn't talk about this Obama thing. But LaRouche says, no, you got it. That's the truth. Keep pushing with that. Don't bother about what people are saying. People are going to tell you stuff that they don't even think. And now we have the proof of that. Is that as Luke and I organized, and, well, Meredith, not Meredith, oh yeah, you were there. We had two deployments, but I was in a deployment in the weekend we came down for Bruce Director. We had a deployment on Saturday in a so-called liberal area. So an area where you have a lot of baby boomers, artists, students, people that did vote for Obama overwhelmingly. And now we're a year after and the response that we got telling people the simple thing, Obama has to be impeached. We had two signs just saying that, straightforward. And a year after, everybody was like, ooh, Obama, the greatest man alive. Yet one person out of two saying, whether saying, you guys are fucked up in the head, you guys should die. And the other person saying, I hate that son of a bitch. Where do I sign up? Mm-hmm. Right? Is this something people will talk about over a table? Not as often. Not as often as when they meet us. And then they say, I agree with you. This guy has to go. And same thing in politics, right? I mean, we know that people are talking about that in the government. They're not going to come out and say, yeah, Obama has to go. It's very rare. But we made a proof of principle that we stuck with our grounds. We said, you want to save the economy? You want to develop the world? Get this guy out. What happened? Well, we won in Texas. We won this the Democratic primaries in congressional election. And we didn't get the vote because, you know, because Canadians have this idea of Texans, where Texans seems to be a specific group of people with a specific culture. But a lot of people will say, well, yeah, but you know, people from Texas, they're a bunch of racists. They're like these cowboy yahoos. And they probably voted against Obama because they hate blacks. And then you say, well, no, because Keisha is black. So they didn't vote for that. But then people will say, yeah, but aren't Texans a bunch of religious kooks? You know, like, think about, believe in Adam and Eve. Say, well, yeah, but why didn't they vote for the minister that was running for a Democrat? Right? There was a minister running, so they didn't vote for him. He got like 20%. We got 53. And it's not like we hide the truth. We didn't hide the truth and then say, aha, you voted for us. We cheated. We lied to you. And now we have, we're going to do all this Obama thing and we didn't tell you about. That's all we said to people. Like, save NASA and impeach Obama. But every candidate was saying save NASA. If you're from that place, you got to say save NASA. Everybody was saying it, but we're the only ones saying Obama has to go, impeach Obama. People voted for us.
Now, Socrates was killed.
Yeah.
Why poison?
Yes, and how come the comedy of
if we our movement?
Yes. Because if you compare Socrates to Mr. LaRouche, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that obviously, yeah, we were,
yes.
They were so operations, yeah. Go
Socrates
keep.
Was killed.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Do you want to know about us?
Yeah, I'd like to know what sometimes surprised that Mr. LaRouche and the other man is still alive.
Yeah, that's
because
yeah, but that's, you see,
especially myself, I come from a developing country.
Yeah, but
I was occupied by the CIA, and they came to Congo to kill everyone who has a kind of idea.
Yeah, you were. Yeah, but you were in Congo. You were not in the United States. As I was saying at the few minutes ago, right? I mean, Socrates could not be in a public office if you want, because he was fearing for his life. He says, I'm going to be more useful challenging people in the street because that's where stuff is happening. But you're not dealing with... we're in a situation where we had an American Revolution, which is very important. But I think that people have to realize two things. That, yes, there were threats against LaRouche many times since the 70s. We've documented a lot. We even wrote books because people like LaRouche went to jail. And some of his best, our best fundraisers actually were thrown in jail for many years. I don't want to go into the details. We can talk afterwards. But there were threats against, physical threats against LaRouche. LaRouche was almost killed in jail just by doing physical work. He was 69 when he was in jail, right? And he had to go to the hospital because his heart, he needed a pacemaker. He had a heart attack. I don't know if he has a pacemaker, but he had a heart attack, so. Was like lifting all these cauldrons and stuff. But they try to shut him up. And LaRouche, just like Socrates, he has a bunch of friends who would greet him in Germany and France. He says, "No, I'm gonna choke now. You guys are destroying the Republic of the United States, therefore destroying the ideas that were fought for during all these generations, starting before Socrates. So I got to fight for that." So there were slanders, there were people thrown in jail. But when LaRouche came out, he didn't stop. There's a proof of principle. If he had stopped, we wouldn't be here today. But he kept going. And people said, "What the fuck? The guy keeps doing it." And now, today, we're at a position where we have much, much, much more support than we ever had. Which means what? Which means that even at a high level, we have support. Because I was saying, we're not... I guess maybe we're going to see that later with Plato. But Plato also had a huge support. Not enough to be able to beat the Persian Empire. But after Socrates died and Athens degenerated, Plato was able to kind of pick some pieces back together and try to fight. But no, we there are threats, but we shouldn't let pessimism make us say, like, we hear that in the street. "Well, if he's so good, why is he still alive? They didn't shoot him. He's still alive, therefore he's not that good." It's like, what, every time you have a good guy, he has to be shot? It's like the law of Murphy. Right?
Because America used to say the only good communist is the dead one.
But you see, but that's a concept. That's the idea of pessimism. We get that all the time from baby boomers.
It's also sophism.
Well, I mean, imagine that was the case. No, we're gonna get a good teacher. He's gonna get shot too.
You're relating one principle, the principle of actually life, to the principle of truth, and saying that they're the same thing. The guy's not dead, therefore he can't be true.
Yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
Like, no, actually, he can still be alive and be truthful at the same time.
You know, so death is not linked with virtue. If you're a virtuous person, doesn't mean you're going to die. It might mean you have a lot of enemies, like Socrates. But what he means is that, and keep in mind what happened in Texas. And we can win this. We can win this battle for a new financial system. And now everybody, over the next few months, everybody's going to talk about Obama. Maybe, probably not in the metro or around Montreal. Don't kid yourself. Don't read that stuff. Burn it. Yeah. Keep yelling.
The government of the United States protect anyway the people of the political action committee?
Well, especially now, I would say. There's not a partisan approval. They're not gonna. They read our stuff, and there are people saying, "Okay, well, we're gonna need those ideas, especially to knowledge." In 2005, already with the HBPA mobilization for the legislation to have a new financial system and protect people from the housing crisis, we got huge support. And LaRouche says they're not gonna try to kill me because otherwise I would be a martyr. Everybody's gonna start reading my stuff, and it's gonna backfire. And we don't want that to happen. But says if they try that, it's gonna backfire. So they're gonna try. And you know, and throughout the world, there's a support. And that's how so great people can protect themselves. Same thing with Vernadsky or Plato. Plato was protected by certain kings. Or Rabelais, right? I mean, the guy reads books for which he would be killed for in the 16th century. And there's a king that says, "It's not going to happen. This guy is with me."
I sometimes thought that maybe in the CIA we might have some kind of Roosevelt people still who can protect or look.
Well, look, the idea of patriotism is not dead. We have a different conception of it here in Canada. If we didn't like fight forever to have our own country, we're kind of being given a lot because of what the Americans were fighting for. But there are people today that didn't like us 40 years ago, or they kind of liked our stuff but they didn't say it. Now they're coming out because these people are losing everything. They're being threatened by their constituents that they're going to be hanged if they don't do anything about the financial crisis.
they tend to side towards with us. But at the same time, you need people like Socrates. As I said, I guess in my class, Prometheus, you need Promethean individuals. People will say, you know, they'll say the truth, and then they see like billions of people saying he's crazy. So I don't care, it's the truth. And you're being told today you're wrong, being told you're crazy, but time says otherwise. And that's what leadership is. Today, that's a situation like that. We need to get out those ideas. People might criticize, yeah, I don't think you're going to win. If you're good, you're going to get shot. I don't quite agree with you saying it's not going to happen, blah, blah, blah. They don't know. They don't know politics. I'm not going to listen to people who read the Journal de Montréal and tell us what to do. They're not evil, but they're stupid. So tell them what they have to do and do what's right. And go back to those dialogues. And also read LaRouche to really see how, in a sense, the difference, as I was saying. Socrates did a lot for civilization. We're at a time when we have much more tools, actually, much more revolutions were made for us to be able to act today. Right?
Which one's that dialogue?
The Apology of Socrates and the Crito, C-R-I-T-O. That's the second one. And then start with these two to get a sense more of a subjective Socrates.
The Apology
of Socrates. And then also look at all of the dialogues. Republic, the laws. And come organized too. Go out there and tell people about sailors and farmers. But yeah, do like Socrates was doing, because that's what we do. A bit different, but the same idea.
Go out and find out how much you don't know.
Exactly. And also show the others that they're the same position. And you'll see who wants the truth or not. As I was saying with Schiller, you know. Some people don't like the truth. Bothers them, gotta change. But others, that's what they like. Also, they like it sometimes because it proves that their teacher is wrong. That's something a lot of youth like to hear. They like to see. Yeah, the teacher being pens dropping down. So, you don't know what you're talking about, sir. Well, I wrote books. Therefore, I know. So voila for me. Are there any maybe other questions, or otherwise we can just break up and.